Hello and welcome to Rainer Hirsch's Prompts in the Pub. My name is Rainer Hirsch. I am a comedian and conductor, and this is my unofficial podcast about one of the greatest, if not the greatest, classical music festivals known to mankind, the BBC Proms, which pitches up every year at the Albert Hall from mid-July to early September, and at the time of speaking, is entering its final week, the final week of the 2022 festival, a week that will culminate with the famous last night of the proms on September the 10th. If you thought the proms was just the last night, perhaps this long journey through 71 other concerts may at last give it some context. As is the case every year, the temperature hots up in the final weeks and the big orchestral guns come out. This year, as in previous years, that includes the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, who have just given two performances. I was at their second gig last night, and as always, there was a buzz in the audience. Why is that? The quality of the individual players, the commitment to the music right to the back desks of the strings, their ensemble, it all adds up to something electric. And I've now had the pleasure of seeing them many times myself, including at their home stadium, the Berlin Philharmonie. But, as I mentioned previously, their regular conductor, Kirill Petrenko, only conducted the first of their two concerts, owing to a broken toe or something. It's not easy for the casual observer to get to the bottom of exactly what happened, but it did mean a change of conductor for the second. Now, of course, we all understand that there are real people involved in these performances, people who can become ill or otherwise indisposed, as the verbiage goes, though if you take that apart, not disposed could sound like couldn't be asked. But since tickets cost up to £72 plus booking fee a pop, I think it's quite reasonable to expect that punters who had bought tickets expecting to see one thing might at least have received notification, a text maybe, they've got all our details, that in fact they were going to see another. There must have been people who turned up to the concert last night who thought that Kirill Petrenko didn't look much like his publicity photos, and that Shostakovich's 10th Symphony was missing some of its usual Russian oomph. The Berlin Philharmonic concert the day before was the vaunted Mahler 7th Symphony, which has been something of a theme during this podcast. Convinced by our various interviewees that I would be missing something if I didn't attend, I was half tempted to pitch up. Of course, it had been all sold out since 2 minutes after booking opened, and you would have to have fingers quicker than a teenager playing the Warhammer video game to get an online promming ticket. Maybe Oliver, the ticket tout, listened to our episode 10, could have helped me out. In the end, rather than do battle outside the Albert Hall, I decided to stay at home and do what I hadn't really done up till now, which was to listen to the concert live on Radio 3. After all, the proms, when all is said and done, is principally a radio concert with a live audience attached. More on that anon. Despite the fact that I have repeatedly dissed it through this podcast, I enjoyed the performance of the symphony, but had my usual problems with Mahler. The canvas in Mahler is so vast, 1 hour, 20 minutes or thereabouts, even hardened aficionados must acknowledge that it is difficult to appreciate in the way that one appreciates, say, a symphony by Beethoven. Most classical music takes work, repeated listening, basically. In the time it takes to go once through Mahler 7, you could almost listen to all three of the last Mozart symphonies. Instead, for your 1 hour 20 minutes of Mahler, you're immersed in a long, rambling narrative which winds its way from opening ideas to conclusion. Repeated listening? Only a huge investment of time will enable you to make head or tail of it. In the case of the 7th symphony, the rambling journey takes in tolling of cowbells, like real cowbells, as seen attached to herds of cows, and a mandolin, by the way. cowbells in particular seemed totally random. What on earth was he thinking? Why stop at the cowbells? Why not have the whole cow? There is one bit of me thinking how great it must be to conduct this music to cue the cowbells. What a marvellous sound. There's another thinking, my life is too short for this. Too short for Mahler in general. I have a strong feeling that his monumental mystery is the main attraction. When listening to Mahler, one is constantly chasing a pattern, a meaning which never quite reveals itself. I've conducted bits of the first, I've played the viola in the fourth, I have a couple of complete Mahler cycles on CD, for example. Rossini is supposed to have said about Wagner that he had lovely moments but awful quarter hours. I'm not sure it's quite that, but there is something wrong with a symphony lasting 1 hour and 20 minutes. Either I am too thick or Mahler is too poor a storyteller. You decide. Regarding the broadcast experience itself, what is most noticeable is how unshowy the Radio 3 presentation is. This is one of the big concerts of the prom season, but unlike the television productions where there are talking heads and general fluffing of the piece we're about to hear, on radio we go to the Albert Hall literally minutes or so before the concert begins. At 6:59, 1 minute before the curtain up, we were actually listening to highlights from the UK Jazz Festival. You could tell it was jazz because at the end the announcer said, "That's nice." Then, as soon as it was over, the broadcast went elsewhere. Off they were, Radio 3, to Turkey, Slovenia and the USA with the latest sounds from the world of new music. Despite this, the Proms is principally, yes, a radio concert with a live audience attached. As we learn from violinist Tasman Nittle at the very beginning of this series, episode 1, the Radio 3 broadcast controls the concert, not the other way round. Whether they know it or not, the world-famous orchestra, the internationally feted conductor, the 5,000-odd people waiting expectantly, none of them can begin their stuff until an announcer in a tiny box to the right of the stage has finished saying their bit.
This is BBC Radio News, Radio 3 News, with the Radio 3, rather, with the news.
Our guest on today's podcast is a person who has held that power in his hands an uncommonly large number of times, Tommy Pearson. Tommy has been a familiar figure in the UK music world for over 30 years. He started as a percussionist and composer, then, as we'll hear, became one of the busiest voices on BBC Radio, presenting most of Radio 3's main strands, including a few of his own invention. Part of that was, of course, the Proms, and its TV equivalent, those handful of Proms concerts, also selected for broadcast on BBC 4, the TV station. So he's done it all, and met more names than you can point a microphone at in the process. Well, now it's our chance to meet him. Yeah. So you started, now, right at the beginning, you went to Maidstone Grammar School, is that right?
I did, yes. A wonderful school full of music at that point.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that where you started hitting things with sticks?
No, way before then. No, no. I mean, I'd been hitting drums since, from the year dot, really. My mum learnt piano at Kent Music School when I was born, and so because I was I never wanted my mum out of my sight, they used to put me in my little cot on the top of the piano. So everyone says, you know, the vibes went through the piano and up into me, all that crap. But it certainly was, music was all around me then. So I started piano when I was about six and drums not that far afterwards. But I was playing percussion as a toddler, you know, in little groups at Kent Music School in Maidstone. Yeah.
You're a member of Kate Youth Percussion Ensemble.
Yes.
You're the first one we were able to get on the programme, actually. So.
You know, this is a long time ago. This is before percussion became what it is really now. I mean, Evelyn Glennie, the great solo percussionist, really blew it all open, made everybody want to become a percussionist.
Yeah.
But before Evelyn, there weren't many of us as ensembles. I think the Kent Youth Percussion Ensemble was one of the first, possibly the first youth percussion ensemble in the country.
Yeah.
And we used to go around all over the place doing these pieces for percussion, quite a lot of Steve Reich. And actually, I was thinking, with the Proms connection, my favourite Proms I ever went to was a three-part prom in, I think it was 1984, so I was early teens. And it was with the BBC Symphony Orchestra and it was the London Sinfonietta. And they played pieces by, fantastic piece, Camera Music Number 1 by Hindemith, which I'd never heard before, but I think it's brilliant. No one ever really plays it. It was the premiere of Dominic Moldowney's saxophone concerto with John Hall playing it. And Oliver Nussum conducted his second symphony. I mean, it was a massive concert. But in the middle was the Canadian percussion ensemble, who called Nexus, half of whom were out of Steve Reichen musicians. So for me, they were real legends. And I just sat there totally captivated as they played Music for Pieces of Wood by Reich, which I knew really well, which is why I also know that they actually completely cocked it up in the middle. I don't even, I wonder now whether they really did cock it up or whether they just decided to do something different. But they were amazing. My mum used to take me, I mean, we were always going to concerts anyway, always contemporary music concerts, always.
Really?
Always the new pieces, or at least newish pieces, or Rite of Spring, you know, which wasn't new, of course, by then, but was still very much seen as a you know, contemporary piece. So it was always that. That was my entire life, was contemporary music. In fact, when I ended up at the Academy, I didn't know very much about Beethoven and Brahms, but I could whistle Mortis Playing a Viva's Voco by Jonathan Harvey.
Yeah.
It was just one of those odd topsy-turvy ways of doing it. But actually, I felt very lucky to have had it that way.
Yeah.
Because I got to see some amazing things, amazing pieces. And it meant that I was never afraid of the new. I was never afraid of the modern, however wild it might be. I mean, you know, John Cage came one year to do Roratorio, which was kind of his music with dance with Merce Cunningham, which they set up at the Proms in the arena, the dance bit, you know, floor in the arena. That was, you know, very, very weird, very strange, very out there. But it never really bothered me. It was always something interesting going on. And I just was up for that. My mum was a contemporary dancer as well. So it was always around. So every prom we went, pretty much every prom I can remember going to, had either a premiere or something new in it. When I left the Academy, I started teaching. My old percussion teacher in Kent decided to leave the area and he wanted me to take over. So I suddenly, at the age of 19, 20, I'm full-time percussion teacher, teaching kids who weren't all that much younger than I was, to be honest. But that was fun. But I knew I wasn't going to do that for very long. So what I did was I just decided that I would write to Radio 3 and see what they thought of some ideas I had for a programme for young people. Amazingly, they wrote back and said, actually, we're kind of interested in the idea of doing something for young people. Why don't you come in and talk to us? I mean, I couldn't believe it. I've still got the letters. I couldn't believe it. And I specifically remember thinking, I ought to wear a scarf. If I'm going to go meet everyone at Radio 3, I need to wear a scarf. I bought a scarf specially.
Right.
It worked. I mean, whether it was a scarf or not, who knows?
Are we talking scarf or cravat?
No, definitely scarf.
Not bow tie. You didn't want under your jacket.
See, 10 years before, maybe a cravat would have been the thing. I was only 22 when we started the programme.
That was the Music Machine.
Which was Music Machine, started in January 1994.
Right.
And I was the youngest by miles. Critics went with it. They, I think, could see what was happening with Radio 3, and this was a bit of a window into Radio 3 for younger listeners. You know, we were specifically aiming at younger listeners, but we knew perfectly well the vast majority of people listening weren't going to be young. So we had to pitch it for everyone. We didn't want anyone to feel excluded, that's for sure. But we did so many programmes. I mean, my God, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of programmes, all about something different. Yeah, it went from 94 to summer 99, which is a pretty good stab at it, really.
Has that had a legacy, do you think? Do you think there are kids out there, or now, you know, with their own three-year-old twins, such as you have, who were turned on to music through those programmes? Have you ever had any feedback like that?
I really hope that there are those people. I'm sure there are. And I have, there have been a few weird times. I mean, thing is, it's weird because on radio, you know, if you want to be unknown, just be on Radio 3 every day for 10 years. But so when someone does come up and say, oh, I used to love your show, it's kind of a surprise, and you wonder whether they're actually joking. But it has happened a few times, yeah. And it's very satisfying. There are a few. I mean, the sad thing is the network likes to forget it completely. I'm forever reading, for example, that there's a new young people show on, the first since Pied Piper, which is always seen, David Munro's show in the 70s, always seen as the kind of, you know, the gold standard of young people's programmes on Radio 3, as if we never did anything.
Mm.
And this happens a lot, of course, on the BBC. They do quite like to do that. I've got them all there. I've got an amazing collection of, you know, raw recorded interviews with people, many of whom are now no longer with us, of course. I mean, big names. Because I interviewed, like, everybody at one time or another. It was incredible. Even Desmond Lynam. I mean, everyone always says, who's your favourite person you've ever interviewed? And I, because I've done so many, it's hard to remember, of course. And everyone always expects me to say something like Pavarotti or something.
Yeah.
Definitely Des Lynam, because he is a proper broadcasting legend. I went to his flat in Chiswick, and I couldn't... I mean, I was overwhelmed. I'm rarely overwhelmed by someone's fame, but I was here because there was this perfectly normal, lovely guy, but he was Des Lynam. And the most thrilling thing happened. The phone went. So he said, I'm really sorry, I'm going to talk. And he answered it. And whoever's on the other end was obviously kind of droning on a bit. And he's going, yes, okay. And he was sort of looking at his watch. And then at the end he said, okay, bye, Motti. And it was John Motzer. Of course it was John Motzer. There I was sitting there, I was thinking, this is amazing. Des Lynam and John Motzer do actually talk to each other on the telephone in their own time. Isn't that great? And I started to get also obsessed with the celebrities' toilets. The sheer number, because you always go, you know, if you're there, you go to the loo. This number of famous people who have baths on plinths. I began to think, what's that about? Like, even John Peel had a bath on a plinth in the middle of his big bathroom. I don't know. I started to wonder what that was all about. It was a significant number. And I thought maybe I should write a book about famous people's toilets one day, because I've been in a lot of them.
So, listen, at some point, you segued from that into presenting on Radio 3. That is to say, presenting The Proms.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is what this is about.
Yeah.
And...
The Proms was the first live programme I'd ever done.
Okay.
Because Music Machine was all pre-recorded, of
yeah.
course. And I was asked to do The Proms that year, 94, which was like the biggest possible thrill, because I was so steeped in The Proms by that point. That was so exciting. But it was going to be live, of course. And it was the first thing I'd ever done live. I really wanted to do live because I thought I could do it and I wasn't nervous. I was fairly confident as a presenter, so I thought I've got to do this.
Mm.
But what they did was, because it was my first one, I went along to watch one being done with Natalie Wynn. And I was a huge fan of Natalie Wynn
right.
on Radio 3. She was amazing. She had to leave because she said the F word rather famously in June once.
Really?
Oh, yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
She managed to cock up a name, I think it was, a pronunciation of a name.
Ooh, she
and
didn't,
before the mic was faded out, she said, oh, fuck. And that was that, unfortunately.
Seriously?
But what was funny about it is that one of the presenters they tried out in Birmingham, because it used to come from around the country in June. And they tried out in Birmingham was Guy Wolfenden, who was a composer at the Royal Shakespeare Company, did all of their productions. And he said something even worse than the F word. He said, it's 6:10 and you're listening to Classic FM. Oh, my God. I was in the studio when it happened. I have never seen people panic quite as much as that.
Right.
Much worse than swearing. I mean, it's honestly, it caused so many... It was very funny. Anyway, so I trailed Natalie Wynn
right.
for that concert. I sat in the little box that we had there in the Royal Albert Hall,
yeah.
absolutely tiny. And I sat there watching her do it. And then the next day, I think it was, pretty much, or maybe 2 days later, I did my first prom. I can't remember what it was, but I remember feeling like it went really well. And it was one of those ones where the adrenaline takes over. And it's not until you finish that you start to panic and feel the nerves, as it were. And I was full of it. I thought I'd done okay. I was really, really pleased. And then the next day, I went to interview John Drummond, who had a flat just down the road from the Albert Hall and was the controller of the Proms at the time. And this was for Music Machine. And I was so excited, and because he was a real hero of mine. I said, oh, I did my first live prom last night. And he said to me, yes, too much chat, I heard. He didn't say it was terrible, so I went with that, really.
The I heard would slightly.
Yeah, so someone else told him.
Someone else told him.
Yes, exactly.
Tell me what's going on in the station at the moment. Well, we just had too much chat.
Too much chat. Yes. Yeah, yeah. But I absolutely loved it. I mean, it was when I left Radio 3 in 2005. The only thing I really missed was presenting the proms.
Right.
Because I felt like I knew it. I knew the proms. I knew the rhythm of the proms. I felt I knew how it worked, the process of it. Even the little things like, you know, when the leader comes on, the timing of the leader coming on, how long it takes them to get from backstage to the front, and the conductor and all the rest of it. I felt it was part of me. So when I ended up doing it, I think I felt ready to do that particular broadcast. And I ended up doing a lot of them because I didn't have children. I was happy not to go on holiday in the summer and hoover up everyone else's work while they were off on their holidays. So I did. That's why I ended up doing a lot of proms, because I was happy not to go on holiday. I'd wait until later in the year to do it. So I did a lot of them.
Do you know how many?
No, but roughly. I mean, dozens and dozens and dozens of them. But the proms was the thing. I mean, I just loved the atmosphere of it. I loved the hall. I loved the opportunity, as I still do, of going in the hall when there's no one else in there and just standing on that stage when there's literally no one else in that hall, as it sometimes is the case. And you're just standing there and look at this vast, you know, building and think of all the history of that place. And it is a real privilege. And then people start to come in and, you know, and the orchestra starts to tune up and all that. I loved all of that. What I didn't like was the box itself, because it was so small. And in those days as well, I mean, it's much better now, but it got hot in that hall. When it was hot outside, it was unbearable in that hall. Mm. But the trouble with the box was it's so small in depth. So there was enough space for you to have a couple of guests, and often my parents would come and sit near me.
We're talking the Radio 3 box.
In the Radio 3 box.
Yeah, that's that one over to the stage right.
Yes, exactly. And so you're in the front bit, in the hall itself, as it were, and then there's glass, and behind that is the producer and the sound engineer. And so I'd have guests, and guests, of course, who sat there, they weren't allowed to clap because it would come on the microphone. But one of the things that really struck me when I first started, and this changed, of course, was you had the old-fashioned lip mics. And so, yeah, which would literally sit on your lip. You know, they had a thing. So it was always at the right distance. And these were the ones that I was associated with people like David Coleman, you know, doing the athletics.
Des Lynam.
And there I was. That was a great thrill. And I bet the microphone I used was very old. But of course...
Did it have BBC in old letters on the front?
No, I wish it had. Yeah, wouldn't that be great? But what it did have was the smell of the person who'd done it the day before.
The COVID.
And, you know, if that person had, let's say, smoked cigars or something, you could smell it. It was horrible. I mean, you'd never get away with it now. And at the end of the first half, you'd be talking and introducing probably the interval feature, which would be played from Broadcasting House. And while this is happening, the people who are sitting in front of you in the audience are walking past you and saying, oh, hello. Oh, I know you. You're from Radio 3. And you'd still be broadcasting. And you'd have to develop a look that said, please go away, I'm still working. But also being nice, of course, because you're the sort of face of Radio 3 at that point. So that was hard work. You know, I mean, you could do a few hand signals, but they don't tend to go down very well.
No.
Because, you know, I mean, this was pre-social media. Can you imagine if you did that now?
Natalie Ween would be laughed, spinning in a classic FM.
Yes. Yeah. She's still around, though.
Yeah, she is. my goodness. I think those kind of moments, I mean, you're aware you're talking to the nation. I mean, you're talking to the nation of Radio 3 listeners, you know, which is basically your mum, your dad, a couple of retired antiques dealers and some people in their own counties and people who are trying to find something else on there.
Well, the problem is their most listened to thing. Let's be fair.
It is okay.
The problem is easily the most
popular thing. Yeah, I'm joking. I'm joking and being satirical. But, you know.
Well, you're right, of course.
You know. But the fact is, you know, you're talking to a lot of people and I don't mean to belittle that. And there is this feeling of, you know, you've got to get this right in some way and a responsibility to say that. And, you know, we're improvising this conversation now, but there's no, you know, we can edit it if something goes wrong.
Yeah.
In that moment, it's not editable. No. It goes out and you say fuck accidentally or when you drop your pen or whatever it is, and that's it, it's gone. There's no way out of that.
Well, and of course, I mean, I remember doing a National Youth Orchestra, Great Britain prom, I think it was, and there were, for whatever reason, I don't even remember what the reason was, I had to do a lot of filling, and I ended up saying, you know how your brain works or doesn't work sometimes, you know, the orchestra's full of men, women, and I realised I'd run out of options. So I just said viola players, because that was the only thing I could think of to do. But those are those moments where, because you're so busy being ahead of yourself, thinking, what am I going to say next, whilst you're still saying the thing you're saying, that your tongue and your brain don't always connect. But for me, those are the fun bits. I think almost everyone would say, if they're live broadcasters, that there's a part of you that hopes something goes wrong, because otherwise it's a bit dull. I mean, it's not massively difficult to read a script out in time, and, you know, do it all in the right places. You learn techniques, you learn how to do it. But when it all goes wrong, that's when you become you as a broadcaster. And of course, the audience loves it when things go wrong, really, don't they? Of course they do. So I quite enjoyed those bits, I have to admit, Jim.
Now, you also, a big forte of yours is film music.
Yep.
And you presented, I mean, now earn your living presenting, well, part of your living. I know you do many things, so I don't want to pigeonhole you.
It's mostly
but you are presenting film music concerts, and you did one for the proms as well.
They did a couple of big film music proms before they became much more
before John Wilson.
The first one I did was I scripted for Tim West, which was great because I was a big fan of Tim West. And actually, that for me was one of the most satisfying things I've ever done, because I wrote a few jokes for him. But I did them in a style that made it look as though he'd just thought of them. And because he's such a great actor, he made the audience think he'd just thought of them, and they got big laughs. And I sat there grinning like a Cheshire cat, because that had never happened to me before. I've never thought of myself as a comedy writer, but I managed to write some jokes that people thought were funny. And the next one I did, which was a special BAFTA tribute at the proms, was with Richard E. Grant. And that was really hard work, it has to be said, because he didn't really get the whole presenting thing at all. We had to work with him a lot. And I was really nervous because, you know, he's a big star. And the director of the TV coverage, because it was live on BBC Two, who I knew, I said to him, I said, I'm really bothered by this because he's just looking straight down the camera at the auto cue. He's not communicating with the audience. In the rehearsals, and he said, tell him, he's an actor, tell him. I thought, really, should
give
I?
So give
I
him direction.
So I did tell him, and it was much better that way. You know, the amazing thing about that night, BAFTA asked me to write a speech for Richard Attenborough, because he was the chairman of BAFTA, whatever it was at that point. So he was coming on to do a special speech, because their whole concert was, I mean, it's wonderful, all British, mostly British film music, you know, celebrating BAFTA. And I thought, that's a bit odd, you know, it's Richard Attenborough. I mean, he knows what he's talking about and he knows more about BAFTA than I do. He's been doing it long enough. But they said, no, he's insisted. So I wrote this speech for him. And then on the day, I went into his dressing room and said to him, look, I just wanted to let you know that it's such a privilege to write for you. You know, I love your films. We had a friend in common because his composer was George Fenton, who'd done almost all of his movies. And George is a good friend of mine. So that was nice. But he said, look, I hope you don't mind, but I'd actually quite like to do my own speech. And I said, honestly, I told them that that's what they should do. It was just a privilege to do it. I think that's exactly the right decision. You go for it. And I thought, isn't that wonderful? How lovely of him to be nice enough to say it. And we chatted about that a little bit. Anyway, it was fine. So then I took my place in the audience. And the concert's happening and Richard E. Grant is slightly fluffing my jokes. And then he introduces Attenborough. On comes Richard Attenborough and then does my speech word for word. And I still don't really understand why he did that, or whether it is that he'd absorbed my speech so much that he thought it was his speech. I don't know. But I was, again, sitting there grinning like a Cheshire cat. I couldn't believe it. You know, here was Attenborough speaking my words. That was absolutely amazing. The only thing that ever trumped it was writing a speech for Stephen Hawking, who came on when I produced, we did Interstellar, the movie, with live orchestra, which I worked with Hans Zimmer on. And I managed to get Stephen Hawking to introduce it, you know, like you do. And he came, but they asked me to write his script for him. So there I wrote his script, and there it was being said in that iconic electronic voice. It was amazing. But yeah.
Did you have to program it in?
Look at that.
Is that a picture of you and Steve?
Steve, there you are. Ugh,
blimey, I wish I had a picture of
something. Amazing, that was an amazing thing.
I've got a picture of myself with Julian Mayers. Go on.
Yeah, so they program it in and, you know, out it goes. That was amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love doing that with the problems, because that was another aspect of the problems, of course.
Yeah.
And having to write scripts to time and trying to second guess what the actors were going to do and all that. I really liked doing that. It was great fun.
Let me just ask you, if you don't mind, what does the proms mean to you?
For me, the proms is all about the experience. It's not just the music. One of my favourite proms I ever went to was the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain in the 80s, mid-80s, doing Gurrelieder by Schoenberg. Schoenberg before he became Schoenberg. It's a big romantic score, fantastic. I knew quite a few people in the National Youth Orchestra, so I wanted to go to that anyway. And it was the hot ticket, always every year, the National Youth Orchestra hot ticket. But you had to queue up, of course, if you wanted to be in the arena. And so my mum and I queued up from, I think, maybe 9 or 10 in the morning. We were there all day, like you were in those days, if you wanted to be on the front, which we did. And so there was all that camaraderie of being in the queue, working out when you were going to go and get your sandwiches and your cup of tea and everything, because you couldn't leave your post, or you couldn't both leave your post, like you could later in later years. But we got to the front row, and by that point, of course, by 7 o'clock, you are absolutely wired for it. You know, you can't wait. You've been there all day. This is the big moment. We're right there in front. Jesse Norman was the wood dove in Gurrelieder that day. Boulez conducting. And we were right under Jesse Norman's nostrils. This is not a place you forget to be, being amazing. That was one hell of an experience. And that, to me, kind of sums up everything that was great about the proms. That community spirit, I suppose, of the queuing up. And then the amazing atmosphere in that arena, which is easily the best place to be to listen. Acoustically, that hall is dreadful. We all know this. And in fact, I've been to proms where I've thought it was terrible and someone who was sitting somewhere else thought it was amazing, and vice versa. But the arena's always been the best place to be. Somewhere middle back, I would say, is probably the best place to be. Behind the fountain. I don't even know if the fountain's there.
Fountain's not there.
It's not there. So
don't know what's happened. The fountain started in the 19th century, and for some reason it's now just some markings on the linoleum.
But that to me is what the proms is. It's that kind of an event thing. And although we went to quite a lot, so, you know, I mean, it always felt special. That's the thing. There was something special about that atmosphere. And even when you're working at it, I think everyone who's presented the proms will tell you that it is special. It's different to other concerts that you might do in other venues and in other situations, even other concerts in the Albert Hall. There's something about the proms that's pretty special. It's part of the history. But it's part of that ritual of the queuing up, which of course they don't have to do now. You just get your arena ticket online. I think that's such a shame. They should do half and half. They should do half of them available online and the other half for people who want to queue up and have a good time doing that. I do think the proms need something funny attached to it. It sounds like it's a stupid way of putting it, but I've always thought that it's terribly serious. I mean, it does take itself quite seriously, I think, the proms. John Sessions and I put together a whole template of stuff that we were going to do, actually. And then I can't even remember how it didn't work in the end, but we were going to have him play a prommer. It was television. You know, like he could do that, where he would just, you'd put him in makeup and make him look like someone else, and he could just become that person and integrate with the real prommers. Because the prommers, with a capital P, of course, are a different breed altogether. They're the front rowers. the ones that I've seen literally tell children, you can't stand here, you didn't queue up.
Yeah, we've interviewed some of them.
Yeah, all that lot. And I wanted John in the middle of them, pretending to be one of them,
right,
for comedy purposes. It was a little series, and you know, we did a lot of writing on it, we created characters and all the rest of it. But I think Proms needs something like that. Someone to come along and puncture it a bit. Because we're talking about classical music, everyone's so obsessed with this idea that everyone's got to love them all the time. Mm. And they're worried that people think they're snobby or, you know, inclusive, not inclusive. And so that all anyone ever says is how good classical music is for you. And I would imagine anybody who isn't in classical music gets fed up, the back teeth are being told all the time how good classical music is for them. If only they get into classical music, they could be a better person. You know, there's all these reports. Oh, if your child does music, he's going to be a better person. Well, I mean, there's an enormous benefit to music. It's wonderful, and I've benefited from it myself. But it's not the only bloody thing that children could do that benefits them. And I feel everyone always takes on the responsibility of the entire industry whenever they speak about it, which I think is a bit of a problem. And I think it needs someone to come along and puncture it a bit.
I think also, I think you're right. I think in the sense that one other feature is, to me, not all the Schubert sonatas are equally good, for example. Not all the way. But if you say to people, I don't think it's very good. I like that one. I don't like that one. Oh, they're all gems.
Yeah.
It's like an insult. I you know, I'm playing the viola very badly and discussing this with the Bach cello suites on the viola. The only thing you can play is very, put that much of that out. But the fact is, you know, I don't really like that one. The first one and the sixth one, yeah. The rest of them, I don't really like, oh, they're all gems. It's like an insult to the whole concept of Bach to not love them all. And actually, yeah. No. And I think that sense of expectation, when people go to a concert and they get a little bit of a meh reaction, is I should be really massively elated by this and I'm not. And actually, well, that's what we, if you're an honest member of the audience, you also think that too.
This is something we should have talked about briefly, is actually the thing that drives me crazy about Proms presentation now, and in fact, presentation generally, or any three, is everything is amazing. Everything is always amazing. And everything isn't always amazing. But, and I'm fed up with people telling me that something's amazing when there's every chance I didn't think it was amazing at all. But the problem with it is, because they won't say that something's terrible, it totally makes their opinion void. Because if you genuinely think everything's amazing, then you're in the wrong job. Where's the critical faculty gone? It's disappeared. And we don't have any format for it either on radio now. And Radio 3 is so awful at this now. There's a new generation of presenters who seem obsessed with this idea that everyone should be advocates for everything, just in case you're not convinced. They need to be the ones to convince you.
Thanks, Tommy Pearson. Well, that's about it. Don't forget that all the Proms concerts are available live on BBC Radio 3 and on demand through the BBC Sounds app. You can also get in touch with us at www.promsinthepub.co.uk, where all our episodes will be available until the sun expands into a red giant, taking in the earth and everything else with it. In honour of Tommy's movie music activities, he is, as he says himself, fairly confident he has hosted more John Williams concerts than anyone else in the world. Our regular special guest, Harry the Piano, harrythepiano.com, has concocted this. Movie music is the new classical music, so they say. Or, in Harry's hands, movie music and classical music are pretty much the same thing. This is Darth Vader's Imperial March, reimagined by Franz Liszt. Until next time, thanks for listening.